Hello, Europe. We are back with a very special episode for you. We're doing something a bit different. All will become clear very soon. But first, let's introduce ourselves. I am Dominic Kramer, coming to you from London this week, and I'm on the line with Katie Lee, who I'm not sure, is she back in Europe this
No.
week? Or have you started your spin-off in South Africa and found a replacement co-host?
Yeah, I'm here spreading the empire. Oh, no, I shouldn't say that, should I, when talking about God. Europe? Bad start. I was going to say here spreading the podcasting empire, but no, I'm here working. Still here in Johannesburg in South Africa, very reluctantly flying home tomorrow to Paris after a very busy week helping to cover the Zimbabwe elections next door. And yeah, I was kind of thinking about just not coming home. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's fine. Don't worry. I'll be fine.
Okay, cool. You won't even miss me. How's your week been? Has your crazy week of binge drinking for Gay Pride finished yet?
I was not binge drinking, and I do not advocate that. But no, it was great. I had a lovely time in Amsterdam during Gay Pride week. And as I said last week, everyone was so friendly, other than one person. I met someone from the Dutch Brexit delegation in a bar on the final night. And he literally just got his job. And he was saying to me, it's going to be my job to get you out of the country.
Oh,
like really threateningly.
A British guy or a Dutch guy?
A Dutch guy who works for the civil service, who was making all these jokes about chucking me out of the country.
That's funny. I like this guy. I want to be friends with him.
And also, how do all these people that like are connected to Europe find me? Again, last week it was the Estonian woman who wanted to talk about European identity. This week it was the Brexit delegation man.
You just ooze Europe out of all of your pores.
Apparently I do.
Sounds like you have a disease.
That sounds disgusting. Anyway, should we tell the audience what we've got coming up in our slightly different special August episode?
Yeah, we're doing something a little bit different this week. No interviews. Get over. Instead, we have a very beautiful piece by my friend and colleague, Deborah Cole. Deborah has been a reporter in Berlin since 1995. She knows the German capital like the back of her hand. And she has a very moving piece for us about memory and Germany's very particular relationship with memory and its history. And it's really lovely, and I can't wait for you to hear it.
So that's coming up later, but don't worry, this episode isn't straying too far from what we normally do. We are, of course, starting with good week, bad week, and we will end with a happy ending.
Thank God. Let's get on with it.
Good week, bad week.
Who has it been a bad week for, Dominic Kramer?
It has been a bad week for, Katie Lee, the Spanish Defence Ministry. The Spanish Air Force currently have a delegation in NATO's Baltic Air Policing Mission. This is a mission that has been around since 2004 in order to protect the Baltic states. What are the Baltic states, Katie? Hit me.
Oh, don't do this to me.
Okay. Estonia, Lithuania and Latvia. We are currently in a time when the Baltic states feel that NATO's help is very necessary. We all know that Donald Trump is trying his hardest to downplay the importance of NATO, but the Baltic states feel an increasing threat from Russia and feel that NATO's presence is more important than ever, particularly since the invasion and annexation of Crimea in 2014. So why has it been a bad week for the Spanish Defense Ministry? Well, one of their fighter jets accidentally fired a missile over Estonia.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
We don't really know. There's going to be some probe into it. But fortunately, it was an air-to-air missile, which self-destructs. So there is no evidence that it caused any damage. Although at time of recording, the Estonian Air Force have yet to find the remains. So the missile was carrying 10 kilograms of explosives. And whilst it seems like nothing was harmed, you can imagine the moment when the pilot realized he's accidentally shot a missile into the air.
This is the kind of thing that makes me incredibly glad that I'm not a fighter pilot. Because I feel like I'm the kind of person that would just put an elbow on the wrong button and then boom! Oops.
Yeah, that wouldn't be great. I think it's the kind of thing that makes me glad that you're also not an Air Force pilot.
I mean, it was never going to happen. Specky four eyes over here.
Did you know lots of my family are in the Air Force?
No, I didn't.
Everyone in my family is either a musician in the RAF or some kind of psychotherapist or psychoanalyst.
Is there like one person that's broken the mold and become a dentist or something?
In my generation, it has shifted a bit. But the generation above me, that's like basically everyone's jobs. Anyway, yeah, that was a bad week, I think, for the Spanish Defence Ministry. And I don't think it was the kind of active defence engagement that the Estonians and Lithuanians have been hoping would happen.
Yeah, not ideal.
Not ideal. But we're staying in the eastern part of the continent for the good week, aren't we?
We are indeed. We're going to Slovenia, aka Katie's favourite country and world's greatest country. It's been a good week for a certain Slovenian comedian who goes by the name of... I'm about to massacre this pronunciation. Marian Šarca. Many people are going to write in and tell me that's wrong. Cast your mind back, Dominic. Way back in the day, before we went on holiday, we did an episode about the Slovenian elections and how the populists had come out top, remember?
I remember. What's his name? Janček? No?
Janša. Close enough.
Janša.
Not close enough. Pretty good, though. When we did that episode featuring the wonderful Aljaž Penkov-Petenc, the populists were struggling to form a coalition and it wasn't really clear if they'd actually be able to govern or not. 2 months later, still no government. Not crazy by European standards of coalition forming, but still not great. Janša and his anti-immigrant party, the SDS, failed to get majority together. So the centre-left has been given a chance to form a government instead. And at the time of recording, it looks like that's probably happened. Several parties on the left, mostly moderate centre-left parties, led by the anti-establishment LMS, they're all kind of getting together to form this government. And the guy who leads that is our friend, the comedian, Mr. Šarca.
Do you know what LMS stands for, the party name?
No.
List of Marian Šarca.
Does it?
Yeah. That's so narcissistic.
It's almost as narcissistic as Emmanuel Macron calling his party
En Marche
because it's EM and it's all about one guy.
Yeah.
What is it with egotists and politics, eh?
I don't know. For some reason, it seems to attract them.
So we don't really know that much about Mr. Šarca or what he stands for or whether he was actually funny when he was working as a comedian. So we've asked our favourite Slovenian, Aljaž, to send in a little voice message from his holiday in Croatia to give us a lowdown on old Marian.
He's a former mayor of Kamnik, a mid-sized municipality, and since Slovenian municipalities are small to begin with, well, that's all you need to know in terms of his governing experience. Everybody expects the learning curve he will undertake to be fairly steep, because there is a huge gap between municipal and national politics in Slovenia. It's not just a different league, sometimes it's a whole different sport. Politically, Šarec is a bit of a blank piece of paper. Nobody quite knows what to make of him, because on some issues he's a fairly left liberal kind of guy, and on others he's a more of a traditional conservative. And there doesn't seem to be any sort of rhyme or reason to his political positions. More often than not, he comes across as a bit of a populist in this curious Slovenian non-invasive fashion. But we'll see how that goes once the going gets tough, so to speak. On the other hand, Šarec has a bit of a ironic streak to him. Before going into politics, he was a performer. Specifically, he was a comedian, and one of his best most popular comedic bits was impersonating a former prime minister, Janez Drnovšek. So the irony of the situation is that we have a comedian who impersonated a prime minister and is now set to become one. And if you ever needed a case of art imitating life, imitating art, well, this is it. Welcome to Slovenia.
Oh, Aljaž, can we get him back on the podcast again soon? Can Slovenia have more news so we can have him on every week?
Make more news, Slovenia.
Do it.
Deborah Cole is a correspondent for the French news agency AFP, just like me, except she's better, and she does it in Berlin, and she's been doing it forever. And Deborah recently wrote a blog post about her job as a reporter in Germany, and in particular the fact that after everything the country has been through over the last 60 years or so, Nazism, communism, reunification, there's now this massive rush to collect the memories of all these elderly people in Germany that lived through these crazy times and are one day not going to be with us anymore. So we thought, instead of doing our usual double interview whammy, we try something a little bit different. We thought we would get Deborah into the studio to record herself reading this really beautiful and moving piece. And it was just such a lovely piece of writing that I really wanted to share it with you. So here she is.
The Traces They Leave by Deborah Cole. Arriving in Berlin in the swinging mid-1990s, I found myself drawn not only to the young people reinventing the city, but also to their grandparents, who were often generous with their recollections, sometimes rousingly inspiring. Back then, there were still tens of thousands of people with vivid adult memories of World War II, the Holocaust, and the beginnings of Germany's despised Cold War division. Sharing their stories often seemed to relieve a burden for them, and for me, it fleshed out chapters of the past I'd only read about in history books. I remember sitting in rapt silence while the elderly uncle of a roommate wept at our kitchen table as he recounted waiting out the terrifying Allied bombing raids as a boy in the cellar of his apartment building in 1945. A friend's mother recalled classmates in the 1950s who were the children of women raped by Red Army soldiers during the Battle of Berlin, some with distinct Central Asian features. Sitting on a patch of grass on a beautiful spring day, an ex-prisoner of Auschwitz and Buchenwald confessed to me that she feared her survivor's guilt had destroyed her own daughter's childhood. While I think seniors are generally invaluable as interview subjects, it counts doubly for Germany, which takes pride in its remembrance culture. The upheaval seen in this country in the last 70-plus years means that the older the person, the more likely there is a rich seam of experiences, of fear and persecution, of forgiveness and love, they might tap and entrust with me. While the hardships my protagonists had to face were often uniquely German, their pain and pluck and joie de vivre sometimes seem strikingly universal. And because the number of those people with extraordinary stories dwindles each year, it has become for those of us based here, quite literally, a race against time to catch them before it's too late. When I heard about the remarkable Helga Weihe, who at the biblical age of 95 still works 6 days a week as Germany's oldest bookseller, I knew she was gold. I started in 1944, and I'm still here, Weihe told me in her charming shop in ex-communist East Germany. Books got her through two dictatorships and would see her through her last chapter too. Beyond being a sharp-eyed witness to history, she was also a key reminder of a bit of advice middle-aged people tend to start getting. Never retire, at least not completely. Weihe has certainly slowed down a bit in her twilight years. She still takes a 2-hour break for lunch and a nap. But anyone wondering why the Rolling Stones are still touring in their dotage need only see the passion that flickers in Helga's eyes when she gives spot-on book recommendations from behind the till. It was much the same with Karin Felix. Weeks before I met Weihe, Felix walked me through a puzzling feature of the German seat of parliament, the Reichstag. Scrawled on its sandstone walls are graffiti left by Soviet soldiers during one of the last battles of World War II. It was a conscious decision to not plaster over these scars of history. A former employee of the guest services department of the Reichstag, Felix has made it her life's work to record and annotate the messages. The long, bumpy road that took her to that calling and her iron-willed perseverance became nearly as interesting to me as those scrawled relics of the past. Felix's estrangement from her family in the early days of communist East Germany, combined with a gift for languages, led her to throw herself into studying Russian at a specialized state trade school. But it was only after the Berlin Wall fell and the city again became the capital of reunited Germany that she was able to come into her own, building personal bridges of reconciliation with the old soldiers. I got the sense that the aging former Soviet troops, who begged her to show them the places they remembered from those terrifying last days of the war, gave her a sense of purpose, as well as an authority and respect that she had long been denied under East Germany's oppressive regime. Whenever I start thinking about the limits of certain career paths, I remember Felix, in her seventh decade, becoming a respected expert in her field and working on her first book. There are so many stories of lives thwarted by Germany's heavy history, but there are also remarkable tales of triumph against the odds, like that of Hartmut Richter, who seemed to walk out of a Cold War thriller. Still armed with steely nerves in his late 60s, he told me about how he had survived a daring escape across the Berlin Wall as a young man, only to make repeated dashes back over the border to spirit more than 30 other people to their freedom. Although he's told the tale hundreds of times, that brief shining chapter has filled him with enough pride to last a lifetime. Who knows when that opportunity could come for each of us? Bravery of a different but equally compelling sort came in the form of Fritz Schmeling, who fought for 6 decades to have his and thousands of other men's names cleared of convictions under a Nazi-era law against gays that remained on the books for decades after the war. Schmeling, still nattily styled with brightly colored braces and his gray whiskers twisted in a handlebar mustache, retained a wicked sense of humor and a zest for life that had seen him through decades of discrimination. And he's made a lot of younger friends in the process, as many of his old friends and comrades die. Schmeling, a cancer survivor, vividly recounted his youth of erotic adventure until he found his life's true love, Bernd. His advice? Create enough fantastic memories while you still can. Young love is easy to find, but lasting partnerships can seem particularly precious for defying all the forces they're up against. Married couple and professional cinephiles Erika and Ulrich Gregor, who have watched at least a movie a day for 60 years, are one such pair. There was something very German about their shared commitment to high culture as an edifying and uplifting force. And they were a sparky interview, full of tart remarks about contemporary trends and politics while never turning the snark on each other. The respect and affection the two had maintained across all those decades of marriage was obvious and brought to mind the old Saint-Exupéry quote that love is two people looking together in the same direction, in this case, a movie screen. Of course, Germany's aging population, high level of prosperity, and world-class medical care mean that the pool of interesting seniors is simply huge. 1 in 5 Germans is over the age of 65. One of my favorite stories of reinvention was a Bavarian grandmother who, well into her 7th decade, decided to pick up and move to the down-at-the-heel Berlin suburb of Hennigsdorf in the former East, where government subsidies abounded. There she launched what would become the world's biggest provider of contact lenses for animals. CEO Christina Kreiner had a crisp, no-nonsense air as she initiated me into the business of acrylic intraocular lens implants for lions, giraffes, tigers, rabbits, bears, rhinos, and even owls, all of which can go blind from cataracts. As a specialist in the visual, she was also remarkably elegant. A reminder that at an age when the world often stops seeing women, self-respect and a bit of backbone can go a long way. Then there are the ones who got away. Like many reporters, I take a wistful pleasure in writing obituaries, which allow me to spend time catching up on fascinating lives. In January, I wrote about German-Jewish swing musician and camp survivor Coco Schumann, whom I long wanted to get for an interview before his death at the age of 93. The melancholic feeling of sending off someone you very much wanted to meet gives you a strong sense of duty as a reporter. You want to do right by them. I was also crushed never to meet Marion, Countess Dönhoff. When her aristocratic family's ancient castle was set ablaze in 1945, Dönhoff fled west on horseback, arrived in the German media capital Hamburg, and helped lay the foundations for independent post-war journalism. I devoured her memoirs soon after I wrote her obituary when she passed, age 92, in 2002. But there were also the highly surreal experiences of meeting the history makers themselves, the bold-faced names for the ages. Various assignments led me to speak to Hitler's favorite filmmaker, Leni Riefenstahl, who's charismatic and elusive, the shadowy East German spymaster, Markus Wolf, dashing with a killer's eyes, and Nobel laureate Günter Grass, a man with secrets, as well as statesmen like Helmut Kohl, frail but withering in the face of critical questions. When I asked him about making way for a successor, he stared at me down with an ultra-formal, gnädige Frau, or dear madam. Journalism doesn't make many promises these days, but I know that when I'm in my own twilight years, I'll have my own trove of stories to tell and memories to keep.
Oh, Deborah, she's got such a nice voice, and having someone read an article like that makes me feel like we're This American Life. So I want to introduce the next segment by saying, Act 3, happy ending.
You need more vocal fry than that.
Act 3, happy ending. No, I need to work on my Ira Glass impression. Okay, I'll work on this for next week.
It's not bad. We We've been getting a lot of reviews on Apple Podcasts recently, and please do keep them coming because we love reading them and they are an absolute joy. I just wanted to share one with you that made me chuckle this week. It's from Luna May Barnes from the United Kingdom. "Great to have you back," she writes. And she then weighs into the debate about whether we should change our logo. "Not a fan," she says. And then she goes on to ask a very pertinent question. "Would you please explain the bleating in the happy ending jingle?" And Lula, I cannot explain it because our composer, Jim Barn, works in very, very mysterious ways and the true meaning of his jingles may never be known. But I mean, I like the bleating. It makes me want to frolic like a little baby lamb.
It makes perfect sense to me, but I'm going to leave it to everyone else for their own interpretation. While you're talking about the Macron logo, can we talk about the results of our Facebook poll?
Oh, yeah.
Which had quite a resounding victory for Don't Change the Logo. 66%.
Really?
Want us to keep the logo as it is, and 34% would like us to get rid of Angry Macron. So for now, I think he's sticking around. Sorry, everyone.
Does that qualify as a landslide? Interesting. That's about the percent that he won his election by. What does that mean? Nothing. It means nothing. Let's move on.
It means absolutely nothing. Okay, happy ending. Our happy ending this week is quite heartwarming, actually. It comes from Spain, where there are around 400,000 people over 70 who are illiterate. One such Spaniard is Encarna Ale, now aged 74 and brought up in the Linares region near Andalusia. She had a pretty typical working class upbringing in that she was taken out of school at the age of 8 to start working in a bakery, which sounds great, but probably wasn't great because she was only paid in food, not money, initially. Oh. And it meant that she never learned to read and write, as it wasn't really an option for her.
Really not great then.
So really not great. Although, I'm not going to make a judgment about what her life was like. Maybe she had a great time.
Fair dues.
Anyway, living a life without literacy obviously has its difficulties. And one of the big difficulties for Encarna was finding a way to keep a note of the phone numbers of her friends and family. So she could read the numbers, but not the names. Fortunately, she has a lovely grandson who at the age of 11 came up with an ingenious plan for helping her. He would draw pictures to represent the people or organizations that his grandmother wanted to call. So he drew a hospital next to the number of the hospital, that's obvious. But for her friends, he would ask her to think of an object that represented each friend, and he would draw it for her next to the number of that friend, and she would never forget their number.
Aww.
So like one friend was represented by a flower, one by a little house, another by a dog. What would you represent me with, Katie?
I was just thinking this, and I was thinking it has to be something to do with your singing career. So I was going to say a microphone, because that's singing and podcasting, but you don't use a microphone for your singing. You use your just the power of your lungs most of the time.
Yeah, but maybe a microphone wouldn't be bad. If that's the first thing that came to mind, then take it, Katie.
What would you choose for me?
I should have thought of this, shouldn't I?
Massive. No, I'm not going to say that.
I want to know what you're going to say. Maybe a bicycle. I don't know why. I always picture you with a bicycle.
Oh, that's nice. I am often on one.
It wouldn't make sense because I live in Amsterdam where everyone rides a bicycle. But for some reason, it does. Could it be an electric bicycle?
Yes, it could be.
Yeah, it would be an electric bicycle because of your family trade.
It's true. My parents have an electric bike shop. I actually very rarely ride one. But it's nice that in your address book, I'd be doing a little bit of promotion for the shop.
Yeah, that's great. So Pedro has been doing this for 20 years now. And it seems to have made his grandmother very happy.
Oh, that is lovely. Thank you for listening to another half hour of stuff coming out of our mouths. I'm not really sure what's happening next week, but I think we might be heading, spoiler alert, to Lithuania for possibly the greatest story to hit Europe in months. Unconfirmed, but that's a strong possibility.
There's loads happening next week. I mean, who knows what's going to happen with Ryanair, whether they're still going to be flying any planes. I'm flying to Ireland at the beginning of next week with Ryanair, so I'm really hoping that the strike doesn't ruin my travel plans, although I am, of course, sending solidarity to the pilots who don't have any recognised union. So hoping they can sort it out quickly. Get with it, Ryanair.
So you're going to Ireland. I am about to go and pack for my trip home. It's going to take me like 24 hours to get home. So if any of you have reading suggestions, drop me a line because I'm going to be in an airport for a very, very long time. You can also email us if you want to just, you know, say stuff with it at europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
And check us out on Twitter at europeanspod, Instagram europeanspodcast,
and at facebook.com/europeanspodcast. See you all back in overheated Northern Europe, everyone. Have a great week.
Hyvasti.
Stravo.